ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You might be obsessing right now over AI or hybrid working, but could you actually be missing the big thing that's going to sideswipe us this year at work? Small signs you might be missing, they're called weak signals, and you'll learn what they are, how to notice them, and what the experts are identifying as the big issues for the world of work this year. Lisa Leong here for This Working Life, helping to make your work life better. I'd love to hear from you. What weak signals or first signs of a change are you picking up at work? You can email thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. This is Lisa. She sent her thoughts about the thing everyone seems to be obsessed with right now.
AI is dominating the conversation at work. But here's the weak signal I'm picking up. AI and human skills are two sides of the same coin. We're so focused on the tech that we're overlooking the human skills needed to navigate it.
We'll hear more from her later. My guest for this episode is Chief Futurist at Thinker Tank, Dr. Ben Hamer. Hello, Ben.
G'day, Lisa.
Let's make it clear from the outset then, what is a weak signal and how does it differ from a trend?
Yeah, I mean, you've kind of described it in your intro in terms of it's the first sign of a change. So if we think about a trend, it would be something, you know, the stuff we're talking about like AI, hybrid and flexible working. So the things that are happening now and in the context of work, we'd call that modern work. But then when we think future of work, we're wanting to talk about the things that are the first sign that something could be coming, the canary in the coal mine, the thing that you sort of notice and you go, huh. That's kind of, to me, the weak signal.
So is this a weak signal, for example? We've been reading about diversity and inclusion, DEI, and what's happening with US companies. Is that a weak signal?
Yeah, so I think because it's, you know, so recent, it's the first instance in that happening, that's when we start to have a conversation about it and the what if that we start to play out, that's the weak signal. If we then start to see that manifest and we start to see more instances of that happening and it become more common, that's when it becomes and moves into becoming a trend.
So we've picked up that Meta scrapped DEI and then Amazon followed. So that feels like this signal is getting stronger. How would you, Ben, convert a weak signal like that into something more tangible, like a forecast?
Yeah, so a forecast is when we then start to play out the what-if scenarios. So what if that would have become more commonplace? What if in 5 years' time, X, Y, and Z? And we start to build scenarios around it. So for me, when I start to think about what a forecast could look like around that, I mean, I also, you know, play it out in the non-work context as well, what's happening outside the workplace. So if you think about, you know, we're live radio, right? So what happened with the helicopter and plane crash in the US. I woke up this morning and read something that Donald Trump had come out overnight and said that helicopter crash was partly attributed to the DE&I policies of air traffic control. And for whatever reasons that he has around that, you start to see the shift in the language that moves around this, that's around the quote-unquote anti-woke movement, that's around, you know, the rise of the forgotten middle, which is the, you know, the white male who feels like with DE&I they've been forgotten in the conversation. And you start to play all those sorts of things out and you start to create forecasts. Well, what happens if, for example, we start to see a regression in equal representation within organizations, or we start to see not just the anti-Semitic attacks that we're seeing, but we're starting to see instances of racism more broadly increase across broader ethnicities and social groups, and how that manifests in the workplace. And we might see less females or people of diverse ethnic background get promoted into senior roles. So they're the sorts of things that we start to play out when we start to see or hear the first signs of these weak signals.
And Ben Hamer, what's the difference then between future thinking and potentially catastrophizing?
Well, I mean, when we think about the future, naturally, You know, when you go into scenarios, it is easier to go into the doom and gloom scenario because they're the ones that we want to prevent. But scenarios by their very nature mean that we want to have multiple scenarios, and we also want to play out the good option or opportunities that could come from it as well. So it's a combination of, yes, you could potentially catastrophize with some scenarios, but it's about being really practical around, well, if that's what could manifest, what steps can we actively take to avoid that sort of future? And alternatively, then what's the kind of future that we want to build towards? So creating a scenario around that and making sure that we're anchoring our efforts towards achieving that one.
And we're going to have a longer conversation as well about DEI in a future episode of This Working Life. So we're going to put a hold on that for now. We're going to get to other signals and trends. Ben, you did some research late last year to identify work trends in 2025. One of the biggest signals you saw was in relation to a potential job shuffle. What did the research show?
Yeah, so we surveyed over 1,000 workers in Australia, and we saw that over 40%, I think it was around 47% of Australian workers had said they're looking to change jobs in 2025. So that's a pretty huge number, a number that most CEOs would be quite uncomfortable with. But of course, it's just an intention. So looking to change jobs is not the same as pulling the pin and doing it. But I was really interested to think about that statistic, or even if you think about that as like a weak signal, and think about, well, what about what we've heard in the last week around inflation dropping, around a potential interest rate cut? So as people, consumers, workers start to feel a little bit more confident, they start to think, well, I don't maybe need to value job security and financial stability as much because we're seeing potential relief on the horizon. Maybe it is the time that I start to look and then pull the pin and move elsewhere and take that other job, because quite a few people have been staying put, whether they're unhappy or they would like to go somewhere else, but they feel like it's not the financially wise decision in the current cost of living crisis, but that could potentially shift.
You're listening to This Working Life on ABC Radio National. I'm Lisa Leong, and my guest is Chief Futurist at Thinkertank, Ben Hamer. And my question for you is, what weak signals are you picking up at work? Email thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. Here's Liam, who's a consultant, with his thoughts on why some people are leaving their jobs.
When we look at what companies do to tackle that or address, you know, retention, whatever it is, it'll be like pizza, gym memberships, silly events, but it doesn't deal with the fact that they want to quit because they're scared, ironically, about losing their job. That's it. And so with my clients, it's always the same thing. Eventually, after three or four questions, it's like, yeah, I'm scared of losing my job, so I won't be myself or do the right thing because I might get fired. But as employers or as a community, we just need to basically deal with that.
Ben, what's your reaction to that idea? Liam says it's a weak signal that he's been picking up from his clients that he works with.
So is your interpretation of that, Lisa, that people are worried about saying the wrong thing and therefore they might get fired?
Yes, worried about saying the wrong thing, and I even think fearing for their job generally, so they're sort of leaving first.
Right, so taking control of the situation. I think that's going to be an industry by industry case. So particularly where you've got organisations that might be headquartered overseas, like in the US, where sort of they have a little bit more of a volatile economy, they could be having things like global hiring freezes. They could be pulling back their international operations. And so, you know, redundancies could be on the horizon for their Australian branches. I think in those sorts of instances, you would see that as much. Am I expecting an increase in redundancies or downsizing this year? I don't think we're hearing that, but not to say from Liam's perspective that it's not happening in his organization or industry. I definitely have, though, seen an increase in people who have said that they're worried that they might say or do the wrong thing, or some organizations that are not necessarily wanting to go about formally downsizing, but we've heard examples of, like, I think it was at Meta, where they fired people for taking extra long lunch breaks, or things that in the past you wouldn't have been fired for. You might have at worst gotten one of three formal warnings, but we're starting to see instances of that taking place where they're able to shed staff without needing to go through lengthy redundancies and firing processes. Again, that's just sort of happening in small instances. instances. And I don't necessarily think that that will be extrapolated and become the norm. But yeah, a really genuine worry and concern.
We've also covered stealth sacking, so where you're forcing certain employees to leave because of your decisions that you're making, like, hey, everyone's returning to the office full time. What do you make of that possible trend?
I think with the, at least in the context of returning to the office, we've largely seen that within Australia. I think in the US, that's going to happen really significantly since the federal government, Donald Trump, has come out and mandated a return to the office. And the intention, you know, behind that is partly that, well, we know that some people are going to quit. And, you know, because they have an efficiency agenda, Elon Musk's department's all about getting rid of public servants, that's going to partly do the job for them. So as far as their objectives concerned over there and what they're looking to achieve, that's definitely part of it. We've done and we've seen a lot of the, you know, return to office mandates in the last 12 months here in Australia. And organisations knew that they would see people leave as a result of that. The thing that becomes, I guess, challenging for the employer is that a lot of the time the people who are leaving are the ones who are highly marketable and can get a job elsewhere, which is why they're confident enough to leave in that environment or situation. And those individuals tend to be your high performers if they're sought after in market. So it's a bit of a it's a balancing equation that organisations need to take. They may go, well, look, you're not a cultural fit for us. If you don't want to come in 5 days a week, that's on your accord. You can leave. But at the same time, you need to be conscious that you're probably losing some of your top talent. But I think that's something that's going to play out overseas. I think we've already seen that happen here. Whether or not we get a second wave of that, that's almost like an aftershock from what happens in the US, that's up for debate.
And Ben Hamer, I think Liam's point made before is somewhat related to this point from Kendra. So Kendra's weak signal is related to the Great Disconnect. So she writes, workers are rethinking not just where and how they work, but why they work at all. The workforce is disengaged from its own sense of purpose and few employers facilitate this experience. Thoughts and feelings, Ben?
Yeah, I'm hearing that for sure. I think particularly, I don't want to overgeneralize with generations because I think, you know, you can get into some dangerous stereotypes, but particularly younger generations coming through, they don't value traditional markers of success in the past, like salary or status that comes with the job title. They want purpose, they want impact, they want to feel like they're making a difference. And while of course I say that's younger generations, I think we're seeing that then permeate across all workers and all generations. They're wanting more purpose. And we saw that and we spoke about it off the back of COVID-19, right? People reevaluating the role of work in their lives. They don't want to feel like it's transactional and they're just doing it for a paycheck. They want it to mean something more. Organizations, I don't think, have adapted to that because organizations are dealing with the economic pressures around, you know, we saw hiring freezes and redundancies, and then we've seen sort of cost of living pressures. We're not seeing salaries go up and keep up with inflation, so the decline in real wage growth. And so all of that means that organizations are still really focused on productivity and how do I get my people to do more with less, which is where the AI debate comes into it as well. And I think they're overlooking the real need around purpose, connection from strategy to role and impact that Kendra's talking about.
You're listening to This Working Life on ABC Radio National. You're with Lisa Leong and my guest is Ben Hamer. He's the chief futurist at Thinkertank. And we're asking you, what weak signals or little clues are you picking up at work that might indicate a bigger change coming down that pipeline? Email thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. Preena has a question for you, Ben. In terms of weak signals, most organisations are not doing anything, she writes, to prep for the mass exodus of the baby boomers. The tacit knowledge that is soon to be lost is going to be immense. What are your thoughts on this, Ben?
Yeah, so this is a really good example of where, like, we talk about AI and flexible working, and that's modern work. But when we think future of work, what's the stuff that's not necessarily, you know, acute now, but we need to be planning for that's coming? This is absolutely one of them. So in Australia, we know that we have an aging population. We have a declining fertility rate. So our fertility rate is 1.6 births per female on average, when the replacement rate to sustain a population is 2.1. Our participation rate, which is the proportion of the population that's working, that's going down as well. So what this is going to see, I mean, there are so many different ways that this can play out. And if you can think of my mind at the moment, Lisa, it's like this mind map of so many different spokes coming off. Like, in the one hand, you go, and I'll try and make sense of this because this could sound really jumbled, but, you know, a declining fertility rate means that we're going to have a much more multicultural workforce in the future. And so you overlay that with the whole D&I debate conversation at the moment that we're seeing, and we spoke about, that's going to be interesting. But the aging workforce piece and the pending retirements, also really going to be huge. I mean, we haven't designed work for people working much longer into their careers. We're also seeing the advent of life extension technologies, which means we're going to be able to work longer as well. So the scientists have said that the first person to live to 150 has already been born somewhere in the world. So
is it you?
It could be you. It could be me. They could be in Australia. We don't know.
And but we do actually have a listener, Steph, who has said something very similar about what she's noticing.
I have been following the weak signals about anti-death, which includes both the Brian Johnson spearheaded Live Forever disciples and also tech like digital twins, which might mean that we could keep living and therefore working beyond our own physical existences. What does this mean for things like retirement if you live forever? And in the future, might you be going for a job interview against a zombie candidate who is no longer physically here?
Zombie candidates living forever. Ben, what do you make of this?
Oh, look, I recognise that voice, and Steph is great for a provocation. Look, I think it's something that we definitely need to be thinking about. Do we need to be planning for it right now? I think we probably have some things that I would say might take priority over that. But that's exactly the kind of disruptive thinking that we want to be playing into. We are seeing, you know, the likes of digital twins, which Steph described. We're seeing the advent of brain-computer interface technology as well, which is shaking things up. So where you get a chip implanted in your brain and you can control your computer with thoughts rather than keystrokes. So the tech's going to be changing how we work, how long we work. It's going to change, you know, in the context of longevity, things like not just retirement and when we retire, but also things like what's the pension and access to you know, age pensions. But what's going to be really interesting in a practical sense here is that a government makes its money from taxes. We need people to pay taxes in order to fund stuff. Now, if we see all these pending retirements from baby boomers and it means that they're not going to be working and therefore not paying taxes, how are we going to fund life and society? And how are we going to fund the aged care system that's going to need to care for these people when they need that level of care? So I think practically speaking, that's for me the biggest issue that we need to be thinking of from a policy perspective. And then we also need to be thinking about, going back to the other listener's point, how do we go about capturing that tacit knowledge? And tacit knowledge being the stuff that you just know from doing, from having been in the role or having been in an organization for a long time, that might not be written down and captured in a policy or a process, but is so important and so integral to how things work. What do we do about that? So we really need to think about how we redesign work, not just to capture information, but how do we redesign work to support people living and working longer as well?
Yes. And one of the things that I like to do is, yes, we're thinking about the future, but I do think, what's the one thing I can do today that might move this forward with that in mind? There is one issue that I think is really interesting. It's come out of your research, and it's basically Gen Z saying, oh, you want to promote me to manager? Thanks, but no thanks. What is happening there?
Yeah, so younger generations in particular, it goes back to this point around wanting to do, you know, it's about purpose and impact. They want to see that the work that they're doing is affecting some kind of real outcome. When you then get into management roles, your role becomes less about the doing and more about managing other people. And Gen Z are getting in, are thinking about those kind of roles. Millennials are being offered those kind of roles and they're going, you know what? It's just not worth the money. It's not, it's taking me away from doing the work that I want to do. It comes with all the complications of managing people. To one of the earlier listeners' voice notes as well, as a manager, you can be liable for so much more stuff now because we hear these sort of buzzwords around psychosocial risk and what happens if I say the wrong thing and then I get taken to Fair Work Commission and I don't understand all the industrial relations complex stuff that comes with it. So not only does it seem like it's not palatable and it's not worth the money, people are then also saying, you know what, I don't actually feel like I have the skills to be ready for that because it's becoming more and more complex. And as organizations, what we tend to do is we promote someone because they were technically really competent. We then promote them into a role where that technical stuff we promoted you for, you're doing less of it. You're all of a sudden going to take on all these people management responsibilities that we haven't prepared you for. And it's only once they've been in the role for a few years, we're like, ah, we'll send you on a leadership course so that you can learn how to manage people, at which point you kind of feel like it's too late. So like, it's almost like the confluence of all of those things that mean that younger generations are pulling away from wanting to step into management roles.
Ben, there were so many topics that have come up, obviously, about the future, but is there one that you would say, please bear this in mind?
Oh, look, the one thing that's really getting a lot of my attention at the moment, and it's still staying on this point around generations, is the generational makeup that we're seeing in society at the moment. And 2025 is a really, really big year for it. So we've got an election coming up and it's the first year that younger voters, so millennials and Gen Zers, are going to proportionally represent a bigger slice of the pie than older voters. So we're going to see influencers play a bigger role in the election. Political parties are going to think more about the values of younger generations. When it comes to those younger generations, we're seeing the first of Gen Alpha enter the workforce this year. The first of Gen Beta was born from the 1st of January. And in the next 2 years, up to a quarter of all workers in the Australian workforce will be Gen Z. And so the biggest thing here is when I talk to a lot of CEOs and senior execs, which I do as part of my work, they spend a lot of time criticizing and whinging and complaining about younger people being entitled and lazy and stuck in their phones. And my response to them, and I think it's worth flagging, is twofold. One, you need to take some accountability for that because I'm a millennial. I kept getting told that you're the generation where everyone gets a trophy. Well, who do you think gave us the trophies? So, you know, to that point, that Gen Z are a product of the society they were raised. And the other thing is, complain about it all that you want, but at the end of the day, the organisations that will be successful in the future will be those that can attract and retain younger workers like Gen Z. So what are you actually going to do about it?
Thanks so much, Ben, and I'm giving you a trophy.
Thanks, Lisa.
That's Chief Futurist at Thinker Tank, Ben Hamer. Next up, try this. Each week, we ask you to try out something new to help make your work life better. We're calling it Try This. It's an experiment we'll run together each week, and this is how it goes. We'll tell you about it, you try it, and then you report back at thisworkinglife@abc.net.au or on LinkedIn. Last week, we asked you to try Tiny Habits, and Sue gave it a go. Here's how she went.
You may remember I was concerned that as a self-employed person, I was feeling like I was always psychologically on and that I would like to be able to work in chunks. Dr. BJ Fogg mentioned turning off my phone at the end of the day, but I realised it was my super fast desktop computer that allowed me to be sidetracked during the day on fun tasks rather than important work tasks. So once I recognised that, I started writing a list of what was most important to do for the day. And whenever I thought about doing a different fun task, I went back to the most important task list and did that first. I started getting a huge sense of success and relief, and my time at the computer per day has reduced significantly. On Tuesday evening, I had the time and focus to plan my next book launch, which is something I've put off for the last 2 years. On Wednesday, I turned off my computer and managed to spend about 4 hours in my garden, which was a big task I've been wanting to do for weeks, but it was a real joy because of all of my other important work had already been finished. So sincerely, thank you, Dr. BJ and Lisa, for sharing Tiny Habits with me.
Thanks, Sue, and well done. And those tiny habits recipe cards are on the This Working Life website. Just click on the image of a notebook and highlighters. Look for the recipe cards link underneath BJ Fogg's name. Or you can email me at thisworkinglife@abc.net.au and I'll send it to you. For next week, try this. Identify a weak signal or something you're noticing at work that might affect you personally. Do one thing next week that addresses or mitigates that possible change. And thanks for listening to This Working Life with me, Lisa Leong. It was produced by Michelle Weeks and engineered by Elise Simons. We're on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. And meet me here again next Friday, live from 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Savings Time. If you haven't already, search for This Working Life on the ABC Listen app and tap the heart to follow all of our stories. And we'll put up another question on LinkedIn next week for you to ponder as well. Until then, love your work.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.